And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. You are tuned in to the Now program with Scott Spears. It is Tuesday, January 24th, 2017, 12:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we have got a big 2 hours today because the conversation is politics today. And we're going to talk with two gentlemen over the course of the next 2 hours that we have not talked to in some time. And what I like about this is they both have tremendous ties to the Marion area and also the namesake of this radio station, President Warren G. Harding. Now, in hour number two today, we are going to be joined by Jim Blessing, the grandson, 100% grandson of President Warren G. Harding, the grandson of Warren Harding and Nan Britton, who was his mistress at the time. So Jim is going to give his thoughts this hour or next hour between 1:15 and 2 o'clock on President Trump. So a little presidential history from Marion talking about the current president. So stay tuned. That'll be up at 1:15 today. In this hour, we're going to talk about a gentleman I like a whole lot. First met now, it's been about 8 years ago. I can hardly believe it's been that long. 8 years ago. He was the author of The Harding Affair, which shed so much light on President Warren G. Harding and Carrie Phillips, and I think really changed the perspective of how people view President Warren G. Harding, and really was there to help start what is now known as the Harding Symposium back in 2009, and I was lucky enough to be a part emceeing that night of that event. His name is Jim Robinault. He's also the author of two other books and lectures nationally with another person who spent some time here in Marion, John W. Dean, on legal ethics and Watergate. He practices law in Cleveland and lives in Shaker Heights, Ohio. He is an historian, author, and all-around good guy, Jim Robinault. Jim, how are you?
Good, Scott. How are you?
It's always good to hear from you.
Thank you.
I can't believe, I was just thinking about it, I can't believe the whole Harding Affair thing was nearly 8 years ago now.
Yeah, it is hard to believe. And, you know, I do think that that book started us down the path of also discovering Jim Blessing, which has been fantastic, because it was Peter Harding, one of the great nephews, who read that book and called me and said, if I'm related to these guys, I'd like to know it, and can we do DNA testing? And our first shots at it didn't work. He then later found some technology through Ancestry.com that would work. So I'm happy about all that.
Well, when he told me how they did the DNA, because for those of people who don't know, President Harding had what I guess we would call an affair. He was married at the time with a young girl named Nan Britton, who was from the Marion area, which produced a child. Elizabeth Blessing. Elizabeth was already gone, had passed away. She passed away, I think, in 2006 when this whole DNA search went from her children, which would be the grandchildren of President Warren Harding, Jim Blessing basically leading that charge. And they there was something, I don't know the technicalities of it, but they couldn't do the DNA just with Jim, that they had to have something from his mother. And what they ended up having was, it's a fascinating story.
Absolutely. Are you asking me?
No, no, it's just, it's interesting how they did that. When Jim told me how they did that, I thought, what a lucky break after her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they looked at toothbrushes, they looked at all sorts of things to try to come up with DNA. And the difficulty is that because this is a female line as opposed to a male line, it's more difficult to trace the DNA directly. And so it's a much more sophisticated algorithm and so forth involved that they finally cracked at Ancestry.com and came up with pretty high probabilities of being able to figure out like second cousins, which is what happened here.
Yeah, and so it goes. But Jim, the reason I wanted to have you on today, you've also done a lot of work with John Dean and a lot of work on Watergate. Now, we got ourselves a new president last Friday, Donald J. Trump, President Trump, and there have been a lot of comparisons made between Richard Nixon and the 5-day-old presidency of Donald Trump. What are your feelings so far of the campaign, the time when he was president-elect and the inauguration and so far the work of President Trump?
Well, you know, it is, to say the least, stunning. I'm sure that you have a lot of listeners who were Trump supporters, but it's funny to me that as I look back on before the election, a lot of those people kept their mouths shut and didn't really say that they were supporting Trump, but they did. And they did for lots of complex reasons and lots of really easy reasons, too. But they, I was really quite surprised by the election result. And I think a lot of the people who supported Trump were not surprised. They knew that they felt a certain way about, especially Hillary Clinton, who they did not like, and about the way things were, and about him. And they, the reason they weren't willing to say much about it is he did so many things that were, you know, difficult, like, you know, the video of him talking on the bus with one of the Bushes, and, you know, all of that sort of stuff made it hard for people to come out and say, I really support this guy, but here we are. And that it was very much a Nixonian silent majority who rose up and elected him. And so I think a lot of people listening to this right now are probably Trump supporters who say, who would want to say to both, maybe you and me both, you know, we told you so, we could have told you so. But it's funny how quiet they were back before then.
Well, just in Marion County here, the home of President Harding, he won with over 60% of the vote.
Yeah, I mean, landslide numbers in Ohio. And it's funny, I live in Cleveland, and, you know, while there were not a lot of Hillary signs out, there was a lot of belief that she was going to win and that it was almost impossible for Trump to win. And then when you travel, I had a trial in Lisbon, Ohio, and I traveled down there. There were a lot of Trump signs out. And so there were a lot of indicators that people could have looked at to see this was coming. But it's nonetheless, it is stunning. And it is also a very unpredictable time because he's never been in political office. He's never been a governor of a state or anything like that. So what he's going to do, how he's going to do it, and his methods are, you know, just completely radical from anything we've known in the past. And so trying to see where he's going to go is going to be difficult.
I'll tell you, Jim, something about that election that shocked me, because we went to the Republican convention. We went to some Hillary rallies. We had a lot of great people on the station during that campaign. Jesse Jackson, Al Franken, Madeleine Albright was on. And I never thought that Hillary was going to win Ohio. It just never looked good for her. But she didn't need it. The Electoral College was still in her. She could have lost Ohio and Florida and still won if she had won Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And right. I believe that until the Friday before the election. The Friday before the election, I took a little weekend vacation up to the tip of Michigan. And Michigan was, by all media accounts, Hillary country. And I had to drive through the whole state of Michigan to get to the tip. And I probably saw three Hillary signs, and I saw Trump signs everywhere, and I was at a restaurant, kind of a restaurant/bar, on the Saturday night before the election, and I was talking about Trump and Hillary, and I said something positive about Hillary, and one of the people at the bar just kind of gave me a very interesting look, and this is in Michigan, very deep Michigan.
Right.
So I thought, uh-oh. I'm not sure Michigan is swaying toward Hillary.
Yeah. No, it was a real reminder that polls, you really can't trust polls because, especially in this day and age with cell phones as opposed to home phones, and difficulty in getting a good cross-section of people. But also, I just think people weren't telling the pollsters what they really thought. And so I think you know, everybody was misled by the polls, and the people on Hillary's side would say that was really difficult because too many people stayed home thinking she was going to win, and had they known differently, they would have been out. And, of course, you got to ask yourself, looking at the marches on Saturday, the first question I asked myself is looking at that show of people across the country and the world. Within this country, the question is, how many of those people voted and how many didn't, you know, believing that Hillary was going to win? And so it's, it's any way you look at it, it is quite stunning.
I want to talk to you about some of the ethical questions and some of the legal questions, being your background as an attorney, historian, and dealing with the Richard Nixon White House and ethics. The first one I want to go to is back before the election, because this became a term we all heard, locker room talk. Now, right. You mentioned it earlier on. Some people claim that it happened. We really can't substantiate any of that. But just on the words alone, what he said, is that locker room talk, or from a legal perspective, is that a sexual assault if it did happen?
You know, from what he described of you can grab somebody and you can do it because you're powerful, and they won't say anything or don't care, that is sexual assault. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. And I think that's the most disturbing part of that conversation. The other parts of bragging and all the rest of that stuff and talking about women in derogatory ways could be considered locker room talk. I don't think, some people talk that way, and it's not like you would be stunned by it if you were a male in the locker room. But I don't think most men really talk that way. I don't see it. But I also think that very few talk about doing something like that where they are acting with impunity just because of their power status and bragging about that. That, to me, is clearly sexual assault in any way you look at it.
Something that came up yesterday, and I find this fascinating because this is still going on very strong, and I want to read the story word for word so I don't get it wrong here. A liberal watchdog group filed a lawsuit Monday contending that President Trump is violating the Constitution by continuing to accept payments from foreign governments at the business operated by his family. It was our hope that President Trump would take the necessary steps to avoid violating the Constitution before he took office, said Noah Bookbinder, the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. He did not. His Constitution violations, immediate or serious, are immediate and serious, so we are forced to take legal action. At issue, the Foreign Emoluments Clause, a clause of the Constitution which bans payments of gifts from foreign governments. The lawsuit was filed yesterday in New York, and one of the people who filed that was Richard Painter, who served as a top White House ethics lawyer to President Obama and President George W. Bush, respectively, so Republican and Democrat. Are his business entanglements cleared up because his sons are running the business, and is he in violation, in your opinion, of this clause?
Well, it's interesting. One of the guys that John Dean and I did a program with in the last few years when we went around doing our seminars, legal seminars, was Richard Painter, who I have a lot of respect for. He was George W. Bush's ethics counsel, and he's a professor at Minnesota Law School, where named after Walter Mondale. And he's a very solid thinker. He's a very middle-of-the-road guy. He's not a fire eater. And I would say he probably is a conservative based on the fact that he served in George W. Bush's administration. So the fact that he joins it, to me, says there's something more there than you would normally think. Here's the problem. The Article 2 of the Constitution has, and you go look at it, about 1,000 words in it. So it is very vague. It's very unspecific. The Emoluments Clause essentially is saying, that you can't take gifts, which makes sense. You don't want presidents being essentially bribed. And so they're looking at whether or not, somebody stays at a Trump hotel, or if they make deals with Trumps in some way, shape, or form, whether those are gifts, whether those are bribes, and whether that falls under this heading. I think, personally, it's going to be a really difficult case to make because there is no precedent here. It's not really ever been looked at very closely, and I think a lot of people think that clause is there for people who are literally taking bribes and gifts in exchange for favors. And when you start getting into somebody owns a business, and if somebody comes and pays the full rate for to stay at their hotel, are they providing a gift to them? I don't know. It gets very convoluted quickly, and it's going to be messy. And so I give it very little of success. But the fact that Richard's involved would make me look at it again very closely, because he is a very solid scholar.
Something else interesting that happened over the weekend, WikiLeaks and Julian Assange have now said they want somebody to send them Donald Trump's tax returns. They want to see them. Now, WikiLeaks has had a good record of getting whatever they get. If the tax returns are turned over, first of all, is it legal for WikiLeaks to do this? And even if it is or isn't, people are going to see them anyway. And when that happens, because the two big things that are suspected in there are that he's not as rich as he says he is, and that he does have dealings with banks in Russia and credit lines and entanglements there. Now, is it legal and ethical for WikiLeaks to release these since he will not do it?
Yeah, very little of what WikiLeaks does is legal. In my view, very little of it is ethical. Certainly getting somebody's tax returns without their permission, I think, is a federal crime. Asking for that and getting that would be, I believe, a federal crime, just like anybody who, without your permission, got your tax returns and then published them. I'm pretty sure that's a federal crime. So that in and of itself is a problem. But, you know, this idea that we are going to have these outside looking in to systems to do what just happened over the summer with Hillary's emails and Podesta's emails is abhorrent. And, you know, there should be a strong reaction of people, you know, regardless of what information is coming out, that, you know, that's a real slippery slope if you allow people to do that or if you allow the government to do that. This is the very kind of thing that, you know, that our constitutional values of unlawful searches and seizures is built on. The government can't do it, and private individuals shouldn't be able to break into people's private information without their permission and then publish it. To me, it's criminal, and it shouldn't go on, and it's a bad precedent to set. You know, where's the limit? And where's the limit with any of us on any of our information or privacy? How would you like it if your emails were hacked and you know, shown to people without your permission? I mean, it's just, to me, it's wrong. And if there's not enough federal law on the books to prevent it, there should be more.
With that being said, when you're president of the United States, because especially if you are a businessman, should you release them? Because is it illegal, as president, to have entanglements with foreign entities who are not favorable to the United States, such as Russia?
Yeah, that's a different question. Whether he should voluntarily release them, I think the answer to that is of course. And I think he should have back at the time during the election. It's his call to make, in my view, but I think he should. And I think people have the right to know that because his empire is so big and the potential entanglements are so so vast that the public has the right to know about it. And the public has the right to know that he's not making decisions based on helping his business interests as opposed to helping the United States of America. And the only way to do that is transparency. And everybody else in the last decades has released their tax returns. He should, too. He should have back then. He still should. And it's going to be a continuing fight about the whole thing until he does. So I think the answer, ethically, should he? The answer is yes.
We are about to start, I think once all these confirmations are done, an investigation into what happened during the election in regard to Russia. The CIA is pretty well saying, with confirmation, that Russia did hack the election, that they hacked the election with the purpose to elect Donald Trump, they hacked to undermine Hillary Clinton, and that the Senate and the Congress will have subpoena power during these investigations. Now, all that being said, if Donald Trump had ties with Russia, whether through business or through verbal conversations through his staff, during this election, is this, you know, how do you win an election, I guess? We're back to the Richard Nixon days. Is that on the level of Richard Nixon?
Wait, say it one more time. Is what on the level?
Is having? I mean, it's a different thing because, you know, Nixon broke into a hotel. Trump had Russia on his side.
Right.
But to win an election that way, when the congressional investigation starts with subpoena power into this, which is going to happen, if we find out that he knew that this was going on, basically that's what they want to know. How much did Donald Trump know? If he knew, is this Richard Nixon all over again?
Absolutely. The subpoena power, to answer part of your question here, the subpoena power of the Senate is similar to a subpoena power of a court. They could subpoena the tax returns and other information. The president would file for what's called a protective order to either not produce stuff because it's just harassing him or to limit their disclosure but only give it to the committee kind of thing. You know, that kind of a battle happened with Richard Nixon over his tapes. You know, that very kind of battle of what you can keep as executive privilege and whatnot. I mean, we had that same battle that went all the way to the Supreme Court. So that's one answer to your question. The other answer, though, is if it turns out that he or his people were involved in subverting our electoral process, I think that would be a high crime or misdemeanor. And I do think that that would be not hard for people to consider that sort of improper involvement in an election process to be a high crime or misdemeanor under the Constitution, resulting in impeachment. Whether they actually knew about it, had contacts, or just it was a wink and a nod, who knows? There's certainly not enough evidence right now to say anything about that other than the CIA is saying the Russians did it, for sure. And they had their reasons for doing it, regardless of whether Trump was elected. I think Vladimir Putin really despised Hillary Clinton from her days as Secretary of State. So that, to me, was more of the bad blood than we want Trump in. But who knows? I mean, there's an awful lot of smoke there. And whether there's fire behind it or not, I don't know. But I think if it turns out they did know and participated in and encouraged all of this, I think that's a high crime or misdemeanor that should result in impeachment.
Impeachment and removal, or impeachment on the Bill Clinton level?
I think impeachment and removal. You know, impeachment is a two-step process. The House is like a grand jury that issues the impeachment, and then the trial is in the Senate. I don't know if you remember that or not, with the Chief Justice presiding. So it is, I think it would, if that sort of strong evidence came out, I think there should be an impeachment and there should be a removal.
Something that was all over the news last night, we knew about this a few weeks ago, that Michael Flynn, security advisor, national security advisor Michael Flynn, who is on Donald Trump's team before Donald Trump was president, talked to the Russian ambassador back in December, a day before the sanctions were put on Russia by President Obama at the time. Now, last night, for the first time, I heard that the CIA was actually listening in on those phone conversations, which I guess is something they routinely do with Russian ambassadors and things of that nature. They're still investigating it. If it was just a hello Christmas greeting and it was just we're trying to set up a meeting between Trump and Putin when he becomes president, why is this still a story? Why was it a story last night? Why do we now know that the CIA was listening? That seems maybe even a little more problematic. And what could that result in?
Well, you know, that particular phone call, that the way I've heard it described, I have to really tell you that I would highly doubt that either person on either side of that phone call would be talking explicitly about any promises of what a Trump administration was going to do in response to these sanctions and that sort of stuff. I really just doubt it. I would suspect that it was a call that was just a, you know, reassurance. We're going to look at things our own way when we get in, and, you know, that sort of thing. And all of that, I don't know if that rises to the level of a impeachable type problem. But certainly I think the American public would not be happy with the coziness of it, and who knows why the investigation is going on. There's a lot we don't know, and it may be that phone call, it may be that they have now have emails that they've intercepted that are important that they need to track down about what happened. There's no doubt, I think, was a lot of communication going on. And in this day and age, there's a lot of ways to track it. But I doubt a phone call like that at such a high-profile moment is going to be problematic. I don't know. Could be.
I guess the interesting thing for most people is the timing of it, when it went down, and also that, it just left my head, but the act, it's an older act that was instituted many years ago, that a private citizen, Nixon, was also said to be in Logan Act. Nixon was also said to be in violation of it, denied that he was when it came to Vietnam. Well, in recent years, we found out that he did do that to try to derail Lyndon B. Johnson with Vietnam as well as McGovern.
Right.
So Nixon lied about it. He would have been in violation of the Logan Act. If a private citizen, Donald Trump, which is what he was in December, even got on the phone, his security advisor, who, again, a private citizen at the time, even got on the phone and gave Russia, who is not a friend of ours, reassurances, is that a violation of the Logan Act?
I don't think so. I think it would take more than that. And, unlike Nixon, who was doing this stuff right before the election and undermining LBJ's efforts to end the Vietnam War, so that he didn't have a last-minute victory to turn the tide towards Humphrey. This call is after the election's done, one. There really is not any quid pro quo to get from it, frankly. A call with a reassurance afterwards, I don't think is going to be all that remarkable. I think Trump himself talked with a lot of world leaders after he was elected, and they're all looking for reassurances that he's going to be fair with them and so forth. But I doubt there was any specific promise, and I doubt there was any quid pro quo for it.
I want to spend the few moments we have left talking about the whole Russian hacking that did take place during the election. When a foreign entity intervenes in an election like that, it's tricky because Donald Trump was different than any other candidate in our history, but he got up at one point and said, WikiLeaks, find her emails. Russia, help, find her emails.
Right.
Even though, did he mean it? Didn't he mean it? Was that just Donald Trump talking off the cuff? I have no idea. The fact that it happened and he did say it, does this put him in somewhat hot water?
Yeah, I think it's the most serious problem that he's got if some real information emerges that shows that his campaign was working hand in glove, if you will, with the Russians. If that comes out, I think that is an extremely serious problem for him, and I think it's an impeachable problem. Now, whether they were careful about it and all you had was winks and nods, that's where you start to get into more difficult areas. It's like trying to prove any conspiracy. A lot of times conspirators act independently and don't have, the actual meeting and the call or the emails or, smoking guns, any of that sort of stuff, but kind of act in concert, knowing they're acting in concert. It just is, it's going to depend on what level of information they get, what level of information is there. And if there was that going on, I can tell you it's going to be hard for people to hide it forever because, just in our email world, it is really difficult to permanently destroy electronic information. It's backed up in so many different ways and with, different people on different ends of communications, having backups of backups of backups. It's really hard to destroy information like that. So if there was a conspiracy going on, there's going to be stuff that will prove it. But until it's proved, it's all going to be seen as just a wink and a nod, and that's not going to be enough.
All that being said, from the gentleman who got the Kerry Phillips letters out before the embargo over, who has studied Richard Nixon, who knows ethics, what does your gut tell you with the information that's been laid out there so far?
About whether Trump has connections with Russia?
Yeah, was something foul going down during this election?
I think... if you would ask me, would I investigate it further and do I think there could be something there and give it a more, you know, like more likely than not, I would give it that. I wouldn't say that it rises to 75% sure, but certainly more than 50% seems that something was going on, because it just, there are just too many things and too many reasons to think there might have been a connection. I mean, you go back, one of the things that is troubling, you go back to the convention here in Cleveland, and some of my friends who are Ukrainian Americans were just aghast at the Republicans suddenly turning against the Ukrainians when they'd always, you know, supported them in their fight against Russia. That just, you know, those sorts of things don't just happen out of nowhere. And so I think that there, somebody could have been involved behind this, and I would, as I say, I would say it's more likely than not.
And again, he, from the man who speaks bad about everybody, even the Pope, he never has said anything negative about Vladimir Putin. Why?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are two ways to look at this. One is that he could be as canny as Richard Nixon was. I don't think he is, but he could be as canny as Nixon was in this sense. Nixon courted China and opened China to be a balance against Russia. The two were rivals for the communist world, and Nixon was very savvy in opening China to create leverage with Russia. The same thing could be going on with Trump. He could be leveraging against the now big superpower, China, to get, you know, to have him on our side and to create some balance and of power against China. That's one thing that could be going on. That could be the reason that he thinks this way. It could be that sophisticated and that brilliant. I don't think it is, but that could be one explanation. The other explanation is that Trump is an authoritarian. If you want to read a great book on that, by the way, Scott, I don't know if you've ever read John Dean's book on Conservatives Without Conscience. It is a superb book. He wrote it about 10 or 15 years ago about the characteristics of authoritarians and the people who follow authoritarians who are also authoritarian personalities. And I think he is naturally drawn to somebody like Putin who is an authoritarian personality. So to me, there are two ways to look at it. One is he either admires an authoritarian, or the other is he's being really strategic about what he's doing.
I'll tell you why I asked that question, Jim. It's because as soon as we get off the phone, I guarantee you this will be the response. The response will be, forget the Russian stuff. The election's over. Why do we have to investigate him? How's he going to make America great again if we don't get off his back? America's done bad stuff. We've spied on people. We affected the Israeli elections. What, the past is the past. Let's just move on.
Yeah, you know, nobody likes to litigate and relitigate elections. There is wisdom in that. There's wisdom in trying to see if we can get past things. On the other hand, if there's serious criminal behavior going on, or semi-criminal behavior, that has to be investigated. You cannot just let it drop what the Russians did and what our intelligence agencies are saying they did. Whether Trump is responsible for it at all is a different question, but we certainly can't let the Russians do this without retaliation. So I think this isn't relitigating the election per se, but looking at a very serious threat to our nation and to our democracy if we don't take it seriously, we're fools, because democracy is not guaranteed. And if you start going down slopes like this, you start sliding real fast if you don't stand up for your country.
And with your expertise and just what we know now, and we don't know everything, and I thought Elijah Cummings, who's a congressman, said something very profound on the day before the inauguration on CNN's morning show. They asked him, he said, are you going to not go to the inauguration like 50 of your congressional colleagues? And he said, no, I'm going to go, but if the public had seen what we saw in those briefings, they would understand why these people aren't going and why, and he thought more people would not go to the Trump inauguration.
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah, really, something nefarious happened. Whether there's a connection between the Trump campaign or not is the big question. Something nefarious happened, and it was wrong, and it shouldn't have happened, and It had an impact on our election. I don't think there's any question that it did. So, I mean, I think it's up to Congress to get to the bottom of that. It's clear that Trump doesn't want to. It's also clear that the intelligence agencies want to. And that's going to be an interesting fight. Another problem that he can sink into is the same one Nixon had, where he's directing intelligence agencies to stop their investigation. That is exactly what happened with Nixon and Watergate, where he asked the CIA to tell the FBI to turn off the investigation. That became known as the smoking gun tape when it came out, and 2 weeks later he had to resign. So there are lots of things that could happen here out of this situation, and the best thing for Trump to do, is, if they didn't have anything to do with it, is to encourage full investigation, full disclosure, and everybody satisfied that we've really looked into this fully.
And just to be fair, just based on what we know, what you and I know right now, you, as somebody who's delved into Watergate and other things and ethics, believe there's a better than 50% chance something happened.
Yeah, I think there's a better than 50% chance that somebody in the Trump campaign, not Trump himself, was in communication with the Russians in some way, shape, or form about all this.
And then, of course, we have to ask the question, between the FBI, Comey, the Russians, but this will be a bigger question about the FBI, did Hillary Clinton have this, not just lose an election, not just she spent the wrong time in the wrong states, not just she wasn't likable and Donald Trump was transformational, did illegal actions stop her from becoming president? Did she really get the screws put to her?
You know, that is another question that people will debate for a long time. I do think that Comey's announcements were ridiculous. I wrote about it. The timing was ridiculous. He has a long-term feud with the Clintons going all the way back to Whitewater. I mean, he was one of the prosecutors involved way back when. So that troubles me, and that bothers me. I do think, though, that Hillary Clinton lost this election because Trump outworked her, because Trump was saying things that people wanted to hear, and that she represented the old guard and, worse, elitism in our politics. And that's what a lot of people thought about her. And I don't think that was going to change whether Comey said something or not. And as I said at the beginning of this program, I think Trump was destined to win. We just didn't know about it because the polls were not accurately reflecting his support. So I think that she had fatal flaws that he overcame. And, a good question would have been, how would Bernie Sanders have done against Trump?
How would Bernie Sanders have done as a vice presidential candidate for Hillary?
Yes, and I thought that at the time that she should have picked him. But again, this goes back to this elitism that comes out of the Clinton days. And I was a Bill Clinton fan back when. I'm not so much anymore, frankly. But this elitism of the Democratic Party and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and all of those people, it just smells bad. It doesn't smell Democratic. And that was their problem. They came off as elitist. Frankly, they are elitist. And it's too bad because I think Hillary was extremely well qualified to be president with all her experience. And we wouldn't have such uncertainty right now about what's going to happen with her as president. But I think she had the fatal flaw that went all the way back to the Clinton days in the White House.
Here's what I want to bring up, just to defend the media here for a second, because we take a lot of beating lately. Two things. When it comes to the polls, because we're talking about these polls for a long time now. 11 days before the election, the last poll that was taken before Comey came out and made his statement, or sent his letter out in regard to Anthony Weiner, Hillary had a 9-point lead in the polls. The day before the election, she'd lost 6 points in that, since the Comey incident. Did he outwork her? I think he was out more often. Did that have impact from somebody who won the election by 3 million votes? I don't know. As somebody said the other day, and I thought it was quite profound, the votes that she lost in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania wouldn't even fill a football stadium.
Right.
So
right.
Did that have impact? It could have turned around those three states, or even one of them, which would have given her the election, or Florida, which would have given her the election.
Yeah, but I mean, she ignored Wisconsin and didn't really go to Michigan very much. I mean, she took them for granted. And
but do you think they turned on? Do you think the Obama? Because people did not turn out to vote. That was her problem. It wasn't that they voted for Trump. They just didn't turn out to vote for her. The Obama coalition didn't.
Right.
So my question is because they thought she was a crook because of what Comey was doing twice in the last 6 months of that election, did that keep those people home?
I would definitely say that Comey's actions had an impact. I would agree with you on that. But I also think that she had some failures that people have to look at. And I do think Wisconsin's a good example. Isn't it a fact that she didn't go there one time during
it is
the final
one,
run?
How do you do that
and then expect to win a state? You know, I don't know. I think there were mistakes that she made that were problematic, and he did outwork her. But I also think, you know, I do believe that Comey revelation had an impact too. So it's one of those things where if you're looking back as a Democrat and trying to see what happened, you've really got to say, look, we got to get beyond elitism. We got to get back to roots. We got to get back to people who connect with, you know, workers and with the standard Democratic base, and not people who fly off to Davos or whatever it is all the time and have their conferences with other elites. You know, it just doesn't work. And Bernie Sanders, I think, proved that he was a pretty formidable candidate because he did recognize that.
Just this is a question I've asked a lot of people, and I really haven't gotten a good answer for it yet, and it does come to those polls. Why is it? Because she, the poll-wise, because polls are done in percentages nationally. When you saw those big national polls, those were percentage of people. Those were pretty well right on the day of the election because she did win the election by 3 million votes. Now, how can that be right? And then again, when we come to the states, because she did lose the Electoral College, how is it that only the polling was wrong in swing states? The polling wasn't wrong in Texas. The polling wasn't wrong in New York, California, places that are either really blue or really red. Why was the polling just wrong in swing states?
I think because those states, like Ohio, are the hardest hit by what's happened in the economy in the last two decades, not just in the last 8 years. You know, I've gone, for example, to Canton, Ohio, within the last year, to talk with some people there about my great-grandfather who lived there and was a Democrat and, you know, that whole history. And, you know, these guys who are in their 40s and 50s don't have jobs and don't have any prospect for jobs. And they've got to blame somebody for this. It's not, you know, the world doesn't look very rosy from their perspective. And nobody on the Democratic side seemed to be talking about what are we going to do about that. So I think that's Wisconsin, that's Ohio, that's Michigan and Pennsylvania. I think there's an awful lot of people who are, you know, badly hurt by not only the economy that's international. What they tell you is it's more automation that's causing this, you know, machines replacing people. And there's got to be some thought about, well, what do we do about that and addressing it rather than, you know, the guys that I saw in Canton who were, you know, basically doing woodworking and, you know, menial type stuff because they really didn't have meaningful jobs there. And that's a problem. And, you know, most of them voted for Trump. They didn't hear the Democrats saying how they were going to change it. And by the way, that's the congressman out of Youngstown, and I forget his last name is Ryan also. That's his theme. And he's a guy who they ought to look to for leadership.
I don't think Hillary would have won Ohio. I don't even think the polls had her winning Ohio. I think the shocking ones, obviously, were Pennsylvania. How could they have been 10 points off in Pennsylvania? That's very peculiar. Michigan,
yeah.
Maybe. Wisconsin, maybe. Florida and Pennsylvania, I think, are that's interesting.
I think you've hit it on the head. There's a combination of two things. One, that Trump did resonate with people who were having problems with jobs, and especially and blamed, you know, international trade for it. But the other is she did not generate the enthusiasm that Barack Obama did. And she knew that. She knew she wasn't developing that enthusiasm. And she picked Tim Kaine as her VP, who is a good man, but talk about lackluster. There was just no enthusiasm for her. And therefore, not only did the Trump people come out, the Democrats and stayed home, in part because they didn't have enthusiasm, in part because the polls told them she was going to win, and they took it for granted. And never a good thing to do in politics.
That, well, and again, I mean, between the Russian hacking, the winning the popular vote by more than anybody did, the Comey letters, and the mispolling by everybody, including the media, which, you know, the internal polling that the Clinton campaign did, that's on them, but that was not the polling that was released by the media. Those were Wall Street Journal polls. Those were NBC polls. So I think Hillary, I can understand why she's upset. You know, some people just lose elections, and that's upsetting enough. But there were a lot of things that went on in that election that really did not favor her, that were not of her own doing.
Right, right. Well, somehow the enthusiasm wasn't there that was there for Obama. I mean, you can look at those numbers and just see the turnout is really different in those states. When Obama ran, he generated the enthusiasm in, you know, in the black community for sure, but elsewise. And that enthusiasm just wasn't there. And it, for some reason, it wasn't developed. And you know, political scientists are going to have to look at why that's the case.
I think you're right. Final question, Jim. The media. The media and Trump, is he doing the wrong thing there, and how close is it to Richard Nixon?
You know, it is very close to Richard Nixon. Here's the problem that Trump has. His character flaw that he shares with Nixon is this need for getting even with enemies and striking back. And you just see it over and over again. He sent that poor press secretary. I say his crowds were bigger because he was so upset by the press coverage and by, you know, the fact that women were marching in record numbers that day. But it was farce. You know, the numbers were whatever they were. He didn't need to do that. Just as Nixon didn't need to have his enemies list and to get even with people all the time. That mentality gets you into a lot of trouble. And the hope is that people recognize that he's got such a strong tendency to be like that, that they will try to work on it. And you just saw, for example, the press conference on Monday was a much different affair. It seemed like they learned from the disaster of Saturday. And you just keep your fingers crossed that, you know, sane people are trying to curb that part of him that wants to get even, win at no cost, or at every cost, at every turn, and not just sit back and say, look, I'm president of the United States, I've got bigger things to think about, I don't have to fight every little fight with everybody and tweet late at night about this and worry about size of crowds and all the rest of that stuff. Just move on, you know. And hopefully he learned that lesson from the disaster of Saturday, because that was a disaster.
We know how it ended for Richard Nixon. I guess we will see what happens with Donald Trump. It's going to be very fascinating. Jim, it is always a pleasure to have you on. This was a fun conversation, and hopefully sometime in the near future, I'm sure he's busy, but I hope we do get John Dean back on, because his take on this stuff is also very fascinating.
That would be great for you.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
Okay, talk to you.
Bye-bye. Jim Robinault, that very fascinating conversation there. We're going to take a quick break, come back with James Blessing, President Warren G. Harding's grandson, for about 10 minutes, and then Terry Tackett's here, and we're going to try to discuss everything that we have heard. So stay tuned.
O'Brien said that won't happen.
I let that
there are discussions to resolve it, O'Brien told Say Today Network in an email.